You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, April 29th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Matt Taibbi on his newest book, The Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. Also on the program today, those kindergarten kids getting away with murder. Time to shut down their end of the year kindergarten play so these kids can get ready for college. Also, the heartwarming story of a guy who nearly lost his life because he believed the lies about health insurance. Meanwhile, in Georgia, still on the heels of their bring your gun anywhere law, six people injured, some critically, in a gun shooting in a town where it is mandatory to carry a gun. And bye-bye to drone disclosures. Senate heeds Clapper's advice. You don't really need to know who we're targeting. Supreme Court is ruling on whether or not searching someone's cell phone is a violation of the Fourth Amendment. Guess whose cell phones will never be searched? Those people ruling on whether or not it invades your privacy to have your cell phone searched. New report out which shows just how many, or at least how many, innocent people we kill as a state with capital punishment. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Just a housekeeping note. Yesterday, perhaps maybe the day before, I mentioned that we would be having a professor from Loyola University, a professor emeritus, I believe, from Loyola, on who sent us an email, wanted to debate me about libertarianism. We originally had that interview scheduled for tomorrow. That's going to be on Thursday. Today, we will be presenting an interview I just did, frankly, with Matt Taibbi. So it will be pre-recorded, but it is still on our reel-to-reel. The tape is still warm. Tomorrow on the program, David Dayan will be here to talk about net neutrality. All that and more. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Matt Taibbi. We are back. Sam Steeder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program Matt Taibbi, author of Now I think it's three New York Times best-selling books. The latest is The Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. And, of course, also former Rolling Stone writer, and now I don't know what your title is going to be over there at First Look, but
editor in chief
of a yet to be named First Look
digital magazine.
Welcome to the program, Matt.
Thanks so much, Sam. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. And I gotta say, your book is getting I mean, your other books have gotten really good reviews too, but this one is getting like it's taken it you've kicked it to the next level in terms of reviews.
Right.
And you're getting a lot of really good reviews, specifically on your sort of like your gumshoe reporting. And
people are saying that I've dispensed with my adolescent literary mannerisms, which is interesting.
Yes, I've noticed that as well.
Probably true.
Well, and I think part of it is that, you know, the body of work that you've done at this point on reporting on the financial crisis and who your audience is, because I think you make this you've made this point in the past that financial reporting is usually for guys like, I guess it's Andrew Ross Sorkin and his ilk, who are really just reporting back to the people they're reporting on.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. No.
And
so my niche is that I'm covering the same stuff, but I'm writing for the opposite group of people. You know, the gigantic subset of everybody else who doesn't work on Wall Street. So.
Right, and the people who just basically get screwed by those you're reporting on. And in this book, you did something. You took the work that you've been doing on the financial reporting, but you also you basically offer almost a series of vignettes where you're reporting on also what happens to those who are not Wall Street criminals, those who just get caught up in the justice system. How did you end up doing that?
So, obviously, I've been covering Wall Street for a while now, since 08, and around the time of the Occupy protests, I got this idea. I just finished a book, so it was time to think of what to write about next, and I was interested in the idea of none of these people going to jail, because that was the end of every story that I wrote at the time. You know, all my stories are the same, right? They're all like 8,000 words long, and then at the end, it's like, and nobody went to jail, right? That's the that's the ending. And so, you know, I was just gonna really basically do a catalog of all these different capers, and then talk about why those cases didn't get made. And I decided, just to do my due diligence, to learn a little bit about who does go to jail and why, and how the criminal justice system usually works. And that led me down this kind of rabbit hole of white guilt, where I just learned about all the terrible things that happen to basically to poor people when they get caught up in the criminal justice system, which to them appears basically like this giant mindless punishment machine. And I really kind of had a personal crisis over this whole thing, because I guess I should have known more about a lot of this stuff. And I felt very guilty that as a New Yorker that I didn't know a lot of these things, that, you know, as somebody, you know, that I didn't know that undocumented immigrants went through what they go through. And it was sort of an awakening. So what I ended up trying to do in the book is just to try to explain what I had learned about how unfair the system is, or how not even unfair, but how merciless it is on the one side, and contrast that again with this more commonly traveled path of talking about the lax enforcement in the white collar arena.
In some ways, it's like a, I mean, from a practical standpoint, it's sort of like a fruit picker that only picks the low-hanging fruit, or maybe the fruit that's just on the ground, in terms of like this sort of bureaucratic machine. I mean, that's the sort of the picture one gets. I mean, let's just tell us, I mean, to exemplify that, tell us a story about Andrew Brown, because, you know, I've known some defense lawyers, but none that, and you know, growing up in Massachusetts, you know, they would do an equal amount of pro bono work and not pro bono work. But when you get a lawyer like this guy's, it's it points to a real problem in the system.
Yeah, no. So I met Andrew. Andrew's a 35-year-old African-American bus driver. I was in a law office in Brooklyn, and he came in, and we got to talking, and I asked him what he was there for, and he said that he had been arrested for obstructing pedestrian traffic. And like most white people in New York, I had no idea what that was. I didn't know that that was a crime, right? And so he pulls out his summons. It's like all crumpled up in his pocket, and I unfurl it and look, and sure enough, it reads under offense obstructing pedestrian traffic. And it turns out that what happened to this guy is that he came home and he was in a tie, dressed with his bus driver identification hanging around his neck, and he stopped in front of his house at 1 a.m. in the morning to talk to a friend, and they were listening to music basically on headphones, and the police came and they braced them up, and this gets to the whole statistics-based policing strategies, because what police are really doing when they stop and frisk, or when they stop people for marginal offenses, is they're looking for drugs, guns, or warrants, and they just figure that if they scoop up enough young black males in a place like Bedford-Stuyvesant, where Andrew lives, that they're going to have a good shot at getting one of those things. So they scoop these guys up. They don't have anything. There's no warrants. There's no guns. But instead of just, you know, letting it go, they write them up for summonses for obstructing pedestrian traffic. Now there's nobody on the street. They're standing in front of their own homes. But this is part of the disorderly conduct statute. And this led me, you know, I ended up learning a lot about Andrew's life, and he tells me this whole story about how all the different kinds of interactions that he's had with the police, over the years, just between his building entrance and the corner, he had been stopped for one offense like that or another, like six or seven times in the last 5 years. And this, it turns out, is just common. You know, what was odd about it is I was shocked to learn that this was against the law, and he was shocked that I was shocked, because that I didn't know. And so that was why I wrote that story up.
And didn't his attorney. Waldorf? I mean, tell us just I mean, because that really, you know, there's a couple of things here that I think it is the case that I think for most white New Yorkers, and that they have no idea that there is basically this separate, almost, you know, way that the city functions. And we've talked many times on this program, obviously, about the stop and frisk program and about the idea, I'm not going to tell the story again, but having had experience with just with black friends in L.A. getting pulled over in their car simply because they were black multiple times.
Right.
Actors who had a nice car. I mean, I don't think there's just sort of like an awareness of just of what this is. Not an anomaly. This is just the way that their life is.
Yeah, no. Yeah, exactly. And just to follow through with the Andrew story. So he wants to contest this case, right? Because he'll be at this point, he's angry enough that he'll be damned if he's going to pay a fine for standing in front of his own house. So he has to go to this court, and that in itself is an education, because the misdemeanor court is this place in Manhattan that is like It's like one of the most miserable places on earth. And you walk in, and it's just a sea of non-white people who have all been arrested or given summonses for dumb stuff. You know, public urination, riding the wrong way down a sidewalk on your bicycle, obstructing pedestrian traffic, whatever it is. And they're all in there, and there's this huge line, and the judge comes in the morning, and he's like cracking jokes, like, "Hey, we take Visa and MasterCard. Who's ready for business today?" You know, and so Andrew gets to the front, and his court-appointed attorney cannot be convinced. There's no way to explain to this person that Andrew's not going to plead to this case. Like, he's saying, "Look, I'm not going to plead because I didn't do anything wrong." And the guy's like, "Well, what, is $50 too high? Will you take $25? And the guy's like, "I didn't do anything wrong. I'm not pleading." And it took forever. It was only after the judge finally brought the police in and questioned them that when they found out that there were no pedestrians to obstruct, that they finally dismissed the case. But afterwards, I go to talk to the lawyer, and I'm like, "What's going on here?" And this old guy, who I called Waldorf because he reminded me of the Statler and Waldorf characters in The Muppet Show, he basically says, low-class people do low-class things. That's why the police arrest people like Andrew for obstructing pedestrian traffic, but they don't arrest white people like us for the same thing. And so I thought that was a powerful kind of psychological statement about why we do these things. And
you make the point in the book that we are we have seen a massive reduction in crime, particularly violent crime, over the past 20 some odd years. Yet we have now an exploding prison population, that doesn't make sense.
No, and poverty's gone up during the same period. Yeah,
I mean, there are many theories as to why the crime has gone down. I happen to subscribe to the lead theory at this point, but. But the point is that why are we imprisoning these things? And I think, you know, you touch on the sort of this bureaucratic machine where stats drive what the cops do at this point, at least in New York. And I think that's the case in a lot of different urban centers around the country. And people are they're just basically padding their numbers.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what happens. I mean, I heard stories about how police in certain precincts were given orders by their lieutenants that they had to empty a pad every month. In other words, a pad of summonses. So they would fan out into neighborhoods and they would look for people to bust for whatever, you know, again, riding a bike the wrong way down an open container violation. There's an interesting side story to that one because there was a judge named Noah Deere who actually told a reporter that he couldn't recall handing down a fine for an open container violation for a white person, and that when he had a staff look into it, they found that only 4% of all open container violations in New York City were given to white people, even though the population is like 43% white in the city. So you have this massive number of sort of nuisance arrests, which may or may not have an impact on reducing the overall crime rate, but it certainly has an enormous impact on just the level of frustration and anger and mistrust and cynicism in these neighborhoods, because people will just become accustomed to being harassed. And it makes them, you know, it creates a very different kind of urban experience than the one that you know you and I live in.
Yeah, and you also talk about the system. I mean, you describe a lot of this as sort of like almost like being on a commercial fishing expedition, where you're just casting
right.
a massive net and then pulling out, you know, I guess whatever it is, the tuna from it, or not to belabor the. the metaphor, but also you report on what happens to welfare recipients. Tell that story. I think there's one particular really disturbing one about a guy looking through someone's drawers. Do you want to just tell us that story?
Yes, sure. There's a program in San Diego called the P100 program where the state is actually allowed to preemptively search your home if you apply for welfare. The idea here is that the state has a compelling interest in making sure that you're making correct representations on your welfare application. So if you say that you're not living with a boyfriend and you don't have some other man paying your bills, then the state then therefore has an interest in going by your house and checking the number of toothbrushes in your bathroom and checking your underwear drawer to make sure that they're all the right kind of underwear. And so I heard all kinds of stories from people who had been subject to this program, and one of the worst ones involved a woman who had an investigator come in and stick a pencil end in her underwear drawer and lift up a pair of like Victoria's Secret panties and basically say, who do you need these for? Like, in other words, if you don't have a boyfriend, like, what do you need these sexy panties for? Which, and yeah, so my mind, when I heard the story, I immediately flashes to some bailout recipient, right, which is also a kind of welfare taker. And I was just wondering whether Timothy Geithner had gone through anybody's underwear drawer after the bailouts, and I somehow really doubted it. It's such a dehumanizing and humiliating thing, and the concept that the state has a compelling interest to behave this way towards a person simply because they are in more financial need than anybody else is it's bizarre and shocking.
Right, and we should remind people that the welfare payments that woman gets are probably no more than, if not less than, what someone in San Diego gets on their mortgage interest deduction. Interest deduction, on their taxes. And of course, you make the point, Geithner never went into any of these bankers, both literally nor metaphorically, frankly, to find out what was going on inside their homes, or frankly, it seems on some level inside their banks. I mean, let's turn to that because that's what the book is about. Obviously, this divide between the way that justice is meted out and then we'll talk a little bit more about the psychology of this, but specifically some of the stuff that I wasn't really up on. One thing in particular was sort of the fraud that was going on in this Lehman bankruptcy unwinding. Will you talk about that for us?
Yeah, sure. This is a really interesting case. I mean, I had a Lehman whistleblower who had come to me after the crash, and he was talking about something else. Basically, he was telling me about his own experience trying to tell the SEC about some shadiness that was going on in the way that Lehman Brothers had been reporting their stock options, the executives there, and that if the SEC had investigated that, they might have found this whole rat's nest of other problems, and they might have saved the company, et cetera, et cetera. And then offhandedly, this person says, oh, and then, of course, there was the merger, which was the biggest bank robbery in history. And I had no idea what he was talking about. And then he tells me this story about how in the waning days of Lehman Brothers' existence, before it was divvied up and handed off to, it was essentially taken over by the British bank Barclays, that a series of
we should say this is in September of 2008, right? Lehman Brothers.
September of 2008.
Okay.
Yep. Yeah. So this is in the middle of the whole world like circling the drain. Everybody's panicking. Companies being married off to company all over the place. Merrill Lynch is jumping into the arms of Bank America. Washington Mutual goes up to Chase. Everybody. There's these mergers happening everywhere. So there was a lot of chaos going on, and but one of the things that happened was that Lehman Brothers, which was the only bank that really didn't get the bailout, its corpse essentially got swallowed up by Barclays. So they let a certain amount of the company go down the bankruptcy bureaucracy, and then they bought off the functioning, still useful parts of it. And what I found, there's a story, and this was actually reported on at the time, it just didn't really make a whole lot of news, was that a number of the executives who worked at Lehman Brothers, who were in charge of evaluating the company for the sale to Barclays, had in advance accepted very lucrative offers of employment from Barclays. And the allegation at the time was that they secretly marked down the value of the company so that Barclays could buy it from more cheaply, and that there would be less left over for the creditors of Lehman Brothers, who of course are all over the world. And so I wrote a whole chapter about this, and there was a lawsuit. Well, it wasn't actually a lawsuit, but there was a legal action to contest the bankruptcy that that went on in the years following the bankruptcy, where there was all this amazing testimony about what went on, and it was kind of this sort of high intrigue corporate mutiny. And what I found was interesting about it was that this is the kind of thing that, while clearly unethical, and some lawyers will say to you was also clearly illegal, it's hard to see exactly where this behavior would fit into the criminal code. It's sort of a classic Wall Street offense, in that it's just so idiosyncratic and bizarre that you wouldn't even know which federal agency would be in charge of looking at it. And by the time it's done, and by the time you sort out what actually happened, it's years later and it's too late to do anything about it. And that's so typical compared to what happens in street crime, where it's obvious what to charge somebody with, who has jurisdiction, and so on. And so that's why I told that story.
What did the bankruptcy judge, I mean, you know, as the son of a bankruptcy attorney, the idea that that the creditors, and people should understand the dynamic here. What happens when you have a bankruptcy is the creditors will get paid off. Those people who are owed money will get paid off based on the value of whatever that company in bankruptcy, as they liquidate, what the value they get for their whatever it is. If it's a shoe store where they sell off all the shoes, that whatever's left, and they sell the racks and they sell the cash register, that cash goes into a pool and the creditors get paid off. If the guys working for the shoe store work for Stride Right, which is going to buy the shoe store, all of this stuff, and they mark it down,
right,
the creditors are getting ripped off. What does the bankruptcy judge say in that situation?
Well, the problem was, first of all, this was the biggest bankruptcy in history, so it was an historic case. The Judge Peck, was under... In his defense, he was under extraordinary pressure to sign off on this thing, and he kind of had the wool pulled over his eyes. The lawyers who put together this deal, they basically came to him on a Friday, right? And they said, "Here's the deal. It's basically a wash. So Barclays is going to be acquiring equal amounts." Assets and liabilities, and then additionally they're going to pay $250 million just to buy the company, and except for the only thing left to decide are a couple of minor points which we have already clarified in a clarification letter, which we will continue to clarify over the weekend. And then in the clarification letter over the weekend, they basically like moved at least $5 billion more over to the Barclays side. So to use your Stride Right metaphor, they marked down the shoes about $5 billion more over the weekend. And then they told the judge this by submitting to him that letter along with 12,000 other documents on Monday. And so, I mean, it was brilliant. I mean, there's no way to look at what they did and not say, boy, these lawyers earned their money. I mean, they're really good at what they did. But it's just one of those things where the layman would look at this stuff and would have no idea that anything untoward took place. You just have to do an awful lot of work to even have a clue what went on, right?
Right.
I mean, you know, as a son of a bankruptcy attorney, I mean, it would take forever just to sort this out for an ordinary person.
And generally, of course, too, the bankruptcy doesn't have to be resolved so quickly. This was in the midst when everybody was panicking and saying that the world was going to come to end. And you're this bankruptcy judge. You don't want to be the guy who causes a financial meltdown, or you know. I mean, I imagine that's the kind of pressure he was under.
And he even talked about that in his final ruling. He said, while we can talk about the fog of war, in this case, there was the fog of Lehman, and, you know, stuff just happens. And so, you know, he basically said, I was under a lot of pressure. You know, we don't know what would have happened if any of this had been addressed at the time, and it's all over and done with, so let's just move on. And so that's the response.
And, you know, on some level, that type of stuff happening concurrent to that, to the crisis, is one thing. But the follow-up from the Department of Justice is really, I think, the most, I mean, criminal in some ways, or the lack of pursuit of criminality is the most criminal. I want to get into Holder and sort of what his sort of famous collateral consequence memo. If that marked really was one of the most important milestones, I think, of sort of this new era that we're in. But also, just recount for us again, too, and I know that we've spoken about this on this program with you, but the HSBC, because that also brings a really into stark relief the zeal in which we go after somebody who supposedly has some marijuana in their pocket on the street. There's no better contrast than what happened with HSBC.
Yeah, so HSBC, just to recount quickly, this is a bank, Europe's largest bank, one of the biggest banks in the world. They got busted a couple of years ago for, among other things, and this is conduct they admitted to in the settlement. They did business with embargoed nations. They laundered money for suspected Russian mobsters, and they also laundered at least $800 million for a pair of drug cartels, one in Mexico and one in South America. You've seen Scarface, right?
Yes.
The movie.
Sure.
So you remember that scene where all the dudes go piling into the bank with all the duffel bags full of cash, and then they walk out without the duffel bags, and the white-haired banker is just sort of sitting there nervously as he takes Tony Montana's money and dumps it in an account. So that's what this was. It was just, you know, HSBC is taking all this illegal drug money. They copped to it, and the settlement is $1.9 billion, which was a record at the time. But nobody does any time. No individual has to pay you know, even a cent out of his or her own pocket, although some of the executives had to partially defer their bonuses for a period of years. But, you know, again, you contrast. So this is behavior. This is what I like to call, like, a crime of intellectual choice, right? It's not like you wake up in the morning and you're like, I don't know how I'm going to eat today, so I'm going to go rob a liquor store. This is somebody waking up who already has a good salary and, you know, decides to go through with, and God knows what pressures maybe people were put under in places like Mexico. But still, this bank took in $800 million of illegal drug money, and that's massively enabling the illegal drug trade. And Nobody got any time. And how do you do that and then put other people in jail for consuming or dealing at the lowest level? That doesn't make any sense to me.
The amazing I remember one amazing part of that story that you wrote about was that the drug dealers actually had got briefcases manufactured so that they were the exact size of the window openings at the teller, so they could just slide the cash in their custom made briefcases, which is just stunning. All right, so let's talk about the Holder's memo. I mean, I think sometime in the past 6 months or so, he reiterated this philosophy publicly shortly after Lanny Brewer was, I think, interviewed and said something similar. But tell us about Holder's memo that he wrote back when he was a Clinton administration lawyer.
Yeah, so he was deputy attorney general way back in the day, like in the late 90s. He writes this thing that comes to be known as the Holder memo. It's originally like a get tough on crime document because it gave prosecutors all sorts of funky tools that they could use to go after corporate offenders. But at the bottom, there was like this little thing called the collateral consequences idea, and all it really said was that if you're a prosecutor and you're going after a big company that employs a lot of people and you're concerned about the damage to innocent victims, so like shareholders or executives who weren't part of the wrongdoing, then you can consider other remedies like non-prosecution agreements or deferred prosecution agreements or things like that. And so this, you know, it makes a kind of sense. You don't necessarily want to wreck a dynamic, you know, functioning commercial enterprise because a few bad apples might have been, doing business with drug dealers. But at the same time, that doesn't mean you can't go after individuals. And they've stopped doing both. They've stopped going after the companies and they've stopped going up after individuals. And that doesn't make any sense anymore.
You know, it's also, but I mean, it's interesting because the idea of, okay, we're going to, we've arrested this guy, but he's got four kids at home and his wife is ill, let's say. We've convicted him, but when it comes time for sentencing, we're going to commute part of his sentence because he's so needed at home, and maybe there's some other circumstances, right? I mean, that's the theory behind the collateral consequences, but it is on a much greater scale. But it seems to me that Holder was preempting the conviction part. Right. I mean, and the collateral consequences seems to me to be sort of a sentencing guidelines or, a commutation type of it falls in after you have gotten them to say there's criminal liability. And since that time, it seems that we've had this era where there was none of these companies have to even admit culpability. They don't have to admit that they broke the law. That's just like we're just going to have a settlement.
Yeah, no, in fact, he's almost kind of punted openly on the idea of even considering the option of criminally charging a company. There was a meeting a couple of years ago, right around this time, in 2012, a meeting of state attorney generals, and Holder said something along the lines of, we're going to make some news with regard to holding individuals responsible for things we tend to think of as corporate crimes. This was newsworthy for a couple of reasons. One is it was like the first time he'd ever said the word corporate crime as attorney general. But the other thing was what he was basically saying is, we're finally going to start doing something, but we're going to go after individuals and we're not going to go after companies. But he actually subsequently hasn't really done either. So he's openly announcing that a corporation is not going to suffer a criminal charge, which makes it, I mean, if you preemptively know that your corporate structure is going to be insulated from a criminal charge, well, that opens up all sorts of negative possibilities. And And that's been the policy of this administration, unfortunately. I mean, I got a lot of people giving me a hard time about overly, criticizing this particular crew of people in the Department of Justice, but there was no way around it. I mean, this is their policy, and
And Lanny Brewer said as much. And basically, it seems to me that he made an early exit because he was too frank about it. I can't remember if it was like a 60 Minutes or maybe it was in a film.
Frontline.
Right.
Where
Lanny Brewer, who's number two at the Department of Justice at the time, basically said, like, look, you can't. Wouldn't be right.
He even went so far as to say that it kept him up at night thinking about the consequences to innocent executives at companies if we were to charge him. And my answer to that is, why aren't you worried about the consequences? You know what I mean? About the consequences to some schlub's family who gets caught up in some stupid drug case, of which we have lots, right? And that person, I mean, you know, just from the people I interviewed in this book, there are people who got swept up and charged with something stupid and lost opportunities to apply for work, or lost their ability to get professional licenses, or lost their chance to get Section 8 housing, and I mean, that's stuff that I'd be worried about if I were Lanny Brewer. But I guess not.
You compare sort of this dynamic to the last days in which you were reporting, I guess, and writing and living in Russia. Will you just talk about that? Because it's an interesting sort of paradox.
Yeah, sure. I'm old enough to have gone to college in the Soviet Union, believe it or not. I studied in Leningrad in 1990. And I remember noticing that there were two sets of rules. There were the unwritten rules that were important, and then there were the written laws, which were basically meaningless. So I would go to school in the morning, and there would be these kids, these black marketeers, who would come and try to trade rabbit hats and military gear for blue jeans, and a couple of times a week they'd get swept up by the cops, and they'd disappear for a while, and then they'd come back out and do it again. But meanwhile, you know, the directors of our universities and of our university, they would walk right past the same cops with wearing blue jeans and wearing foreign suits, and nothing would happen to them, even though we're talking about the same offense, because they're not supposed to be involved in trading, they're not supposed to be, you know, wearing black market stuff. But it's just the idea is, and Soviets understood this instinctively, just some people get in trouble and other people don't. And I think we're kind of, I mean, that's an exaggerated version of what I'm talking about here, but we're kind of going through the same phenomenon where we just think of certain people as being, you know, the kind of people who go to jail, and other people as being the kind of people who don't go to jail. And that psychological distinction is dangerous, because it starts to inform the decisions of people in government. It just has far-reaching consequences once you get to that sort of unconscious sorting stage of things.
And it's almost like the laws become almost like alibis. Like, you know, if we decide that you're a person who is going to be held accountable, we will exercise the law that's on the books. If we decide that you're not, we don't need to use that alibi for coming after you, because we just decide that you're not somebody who's going to be subject to the laws. I mean, what?
I mean, exactly. No, it's a tool that law enforcement can use when you're able to selectively prosecute people for things. Then it becomes this really powerful tool for law enforcement to, you know, in Russia, the dynamic was if you had engaged in capitalist commerce, if you had dollars, if you had did any of those things, which everybody did, right? I mean, nobody got through a day without doing something that was against Soviet law. But they were able to, if they didn't like one person in particular, they could just go into that person's home and find the six or seven ways that person had violated Soviet rules, and take that person away. Well, we have something similar with the drug laws. I mean, you know, everybody, a lot of people do illegal drugs in this country, right? And if the police wanted to, they could make a case against all kinds of people. But what they don't really do that. They beef their stats up by massively going after people in certain neighborhoods. And then in the rest of the cases, they only make, you know, the really rich dude on cocaine case when they can't help it but make the case. When, you know, when the guy, you know, drives into an old folks home with his Maserati and you know, kills a bunch of people, that's when that case gets made. They just don't, they selectively enforce those kinds of laws. And that gives law enforcement a powerful tool when everybody's guilty of something, but you only go after some of the people some of the time.
Well, do you think this is a change? I mean, you know, has something fundamentally changed in our society over the past? I don't know. I mean, I think the 90s were really unhealthy for this country in many ways. I mean, I think we were on the road on some level. But, you know, you look back into Bill Black has talked about the savings and loans crisis. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of people who were prosecuted. I mean, over 1,000, I believe. Well over 1,000.
Right, yeah. We threw 800 people in jail. Yep.
And something has changed. And I don't know. I mean, I've talked on this program quite a bit that my sense of the 90s was when money finally became the singular ascendant value in our society amongst everybody. There was
right.
No, you know, I mean, there was no part of society where money wasn't the ascendant value. So if you had money, you had every other value that had been valued in society, whether it was you're a good person, you have integrity, you're a pillar of society, whatever it is. If you had money, you automatically accrued those things, and the opposite being the case as well. If you didn't have money, you were none of those things.
Right, yeah, there was this thing, I think you're absolutely right. There was something that happened to us during that period where, and maybe even started a little bit earlier, where we just started to look at people who were at the bottom of society completely without compassion. And it might have been when, you know, our manufacturing economy started to disappear and things got tighter economically for all of us. And it might have been when both parties decided to pile on the same direction in terms of welfare reform, and both parties started courting Wall Street and deregulation, so they had unanimity on that idea as well. So there was political support for the very wealthy, and there was no more lobby for the very poor. And then there, you know, the media messages about what it meant to no longer to not have money, to not be rich, to not be good looking, to have bad teeth, whatever it is. I mean, I think those things really accelerated in the 90s, and we developed this really unhealthy way of looking at the world, where somebody who's at the bottom and you know, doesn't have a lot of things, and that person's already inherently a little bit guilty of something. You know what I mean? And so it's not that much of a reach to start thinking about that person as being also criminally guilty of something. I know that's a very vague way of putting it, but as an explanation for this phenomenon, I mean, don't you think that there's something, there's a little bit of something there? I don't know.
Definitely.
I can't.
I definitely think that's the case, and I, you know, and I've talked to different people over the years as to what, you know, what it was. Fran Lebowitz told me she thought it was pegged to when lawyers started advertising.
Right.
But I think, you know, and maybe on some level it was the fall of the Soviet Union basically said we're off to the races. But I think all of those things that you've listed happened during that era, and I don't know if it was all just if it was political. I don't know if it was the advent of cable television. Who knows? But certainly something happened where the idea that if you you were okay if you had money, and you were not okay if you didn't, and that simple premise seems to have just exploded, and now we see our society organized in that way, and it's really problematic. But it's great stuff. Matt Taibbi, the book is The Divide, American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. Thanks so much for your time today. We will obviously put a link to your book, majority.fm. Always a pleasure, Matt.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Sam, and have a good day.
You too. All right, folks. We're going to take a break, head into the funner half of the program, wherein we will chastise kindergarten kids for just not getting their act together. Come on.
Dude, seriously. I know you're in kindergarten and everything, but my God, bro.
You've been waiting.
I've been waiting like all morning, literally, to just sort of do that on the air.
Folks, it is your support that makes this program possible. If you have the financial means to become a member, please, we need your support. You can become a member today at majority.fm. If you, and as a way of saying thank you, we give you an extra 50 minutes a day. You could literally never listen to the first half of the show and still get an entirely new show. If you want to be a member, you don't have the financial means, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We will not lock anyone out for financial reasons. And if you're a member and you've come upon hard times, it happens more often than one would like to think, not for the sake of the show, but really for the sake of folks out there. Also, please don't hesitate to email us. We will work something out for you. Again, become a member today at majority.fm. If you buy crap from Amazon, go to majorityreportkickback.com. Click on the Amazon link. Bookmark it. Buy all your crap from Amazon through that link. We get a kickback. That's why we call it majorityreportkickback.com. JustCoffee.coop. It's a co-op. That's why it's justcoffee.coop as opposed to .com. Fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Buy the Majority FM blend. Show Mark Maron a thing or two. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. You can IM us at Majority FM. We will take your phone calls back in just a moment.